WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington. Welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nambi. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Ed Lazier. He is the executive director of the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon. And listen, I have lost my phone. It's been gone since I took a little ride on my bike yesterday. And so I'm totally discombobulated.
If you have found Tom Sherwood's phone anyplace, please make sure that you... Where should they return it? To NBC4?
Well, we've killed it. I don't know. It's probably sold on the black market or something. I don't know.
Well, who knows? Someone might be kind enough to want to return it to you. Joining us in studio is Frank Wagner. He's a member of the Virginia State Senate representing the 7th District, which includes parts of Virginia Beach and Norfolk. He's been part of the Virginia legislature for 25 years. He previously served in the House of Delegates. He's a Republican running for governor of Virginia. Senator Wagner, thank you for joining us.
Kojo, it's a pleasure to be here.
If you have questions or comments for the senator, give us a call, 800-433-8850. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream of the broadcast, shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show, or send email to kojo@wamu.org. Before we talk with the senator, Tom Sherwood, let's talk about Maryland, where Ben Jealous, the former head of the NAACP, has officially launched his campaign, according to the Washington Post, for the Democratic nomination. He, of course, is going to be running against who is a popular Republican incumbent, Larry Hogan, and Ben Jealous is identified as a Bernie Sanders progressive.
Well, before he even gets to think about Larry Hogan, he's going to have a half dozen probably other Democrats running for that same race. This is, you know, Mr. Jealous's first foray into elective politics. He was a Bernie Sanders surrogate on the campaign trail last year. But, you know, this is a nationwide thing for Democrats who are all horrified that Trump won. And so they're all running out trying to be active in the Democratic Party, thinking that the party sat on its hands too much in 2016. But there's a difference between being anti-Trump and running the state like Maryland, which has a fairly strong Democratic presence, of course, just as it's kind of what's happening in Virginia, where Tom Perriello is running for governor on an anti-Trump campaign rather than on his knowledge of the state. So it's interesting to see. And Jealous certainly has name recognition, having run the NAACP, I think the youngest person ever to run that organization. But he's got some serious potential candidates who will be in that race.
And several term-limited Montgomery County Council members are running for county executive, already announced Mark Elrich and George Leventhon. And yesterday, three-term incumbent Roger Berliner announced that he's throwing his hat in that race. He joined us to talk about the Purple Line yesterday with our transportation reporter Martin DeCaro, and missed the opportunity to announce that he was running for county executive.
Well, apparently you've done it for him. But, well, you know, those formal announcements, you know, I just get tired of those formal announcements. We know when people are running. We should talk to them and treat them like they're candidates, whether they've had a balloon ceremony or not. And Berlin is there. He was clear for the last 6-7 months he's going to do it. So he's doing it. The politics in Montgomery County are exploding because of the term limits. And we'll just see what happens.
Even if he just let it slip on this broadcast yesterday, it would have improved his chances for success.
Well, I don't know about that.
That's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Senator Wagner, you have been in the Virginia legislature for 25 years. Why are you running for governor? And how long have you been planning to do this?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about it for the last few years. Several things had to fall into place for me to allow the time to do it. I've been a business owner all my life and sold my business 2 years ago. Obviously, that freed up the time to contemplate running for governor. The district I represented voted for Barack Obama twice. And the legislature in Virginia is 21, the Senate anyway, is 21 Republicans and 19 Democrats. So in 2015, they threw everything but the kitchen sink at me in an attempt to get me out of office, including $2.4 million spent on the Democrat side, which is a phenomenal amount of money for a state Senate race. But I defeated my opponent by 10 percentage points, which I think speaks to the the appeal, at least in my region of the state, but I think all over the state, for the positive message and that we've been putting out. Looked at the other two candidates, and quite frankly, I just don't think they have anything to offer for Virginia. And when the Republicans chose a primary over a convention, then that convinced me that this was the time to do it, because I believe my message is striking home across Virginia. People get it. People understand. It's not rhetoric as usual. You know, I was in a Washington Post debate, and they kept trying to bring up statues or this or the other thing. And I kept saying, why don't we talk about something that Northern Virginians really care about? Let's talk about transportation, because I'm the only one out there talking about more transportation funding. What do people look to Richmond for? That, you know,
well,
they're
a lot
looking
of
to Richmond. Yeah, right, right. But one of those things clearly in Northern Virginia is transportation.
Why didn't you think you could prevail in a convention?
Well, I tell you, there's so many Republicans that have to stay home for any number of reasons. First, some may not have the funds to go to a convention. Second, people work. Third, I mean, you're talking about June. There's high school graduations. There's 1,000 reasons why someone might not be able to go to Roanoke or Richmond to give up basically 48 hours, rent a hotel room, and go up there. So it tends to attract folks that sometimes may not be representative of the big, broad tent that the Republican Party is.
Very conservative.
Right.
We're only, 12 days from the primary?
Exactly.
10, 12 days? You're not very well known up here in Northern Virginia. You have a distinguished career in the state legislature. I was reading about you, discovered that you were a certified scuba diver, and you know, that was interesting. But you also went to Washington and Lee High School in Arlington. Is that correct?
I did. Graduated from there and went right to the Naval Academy 2 weeks later.
In a campaign, normally you start out with advertising that introduces you to the voters, and then you talk about the issues. Then maybe you do some contrasting negative ads against your opponents, and then you do get out the vote ads.
Right.
That's a lot of money. You don't have the money to do all that kind of thing. How do you see yourself playing out on June the 13th?
People
in Northern Virginia come out and vote for you? Why?
Yeah, I think so, because the message is out. And if there's a takeaway from the last three campaign cycles, I think anybody should take away, the typical methods of campaigning have changed. Social media has taken over a broad aspect of that, away from the traditional forms, say newspapers and radio and TV. We are running radio in Northern Virginia. We're running it on drive time radio on the two major stations that people listen to, trying to avoid traffic. It's not NPR, unfortunately, but it is. And it's not WAMU, but it is TOP and MAL, Who's Kidding Who, and that's who listen people try to. And we're bringing that positive message. We have gotten just excellent feedback from Northern Virginia. I don't spot anything. I grew up here. I still have, brothers that live up here. So we have a network up here that doesn't show up on anybody's polls, that nobody's going to poll. And we have a message out here that strikes home to the number one issue in Northern Virginia. And that number one issue in Northern Virginia today is, how do I get back and forth to work? How do I get back to my family? How do I do those things? And they're watching these hot lanes with sometimes getting $20, $30 tolls going up, and no one, Democrat or Republican, it's amazing to me, no one's addressing the number one issue that faces the capital region in terms of, what do you look to your state government for? You look to your state government for transportation.
I was about to say, if they're not addressing it and you are,
what is it?
What would you do as governor to help address it?
Well, I think, and I've said it, and I've been that one Republican, Tom, that has actually said, look, we don't have enough money. We're going to have to raise fuel taxes to get to the numbers that we need to be able to try to address these situations. Look, there's only two ways to pay for roads.
I thought you were going to include Metro in it, because Metro,
well, absolutely.
Virginia's like taking a powder on Metro.
Well, I'll give you my thoughts on Metro here, but let's talk transportation funding as a whole, because understand that in Virginia, 18% of all money goes in transportation trust fund is then reprogrammed back out to mass transit systems across Virginia. So when I start talking about a transportation pot, I'm also talking about more money for mass transit. Let's go into that. So what I proposed is basically a sliding scale. Go back to a per-gallon tax, which when we did the transportation bill 3 years ago that raised $1 billion, we went to a percentage sales tax. So let's go back to a per-gallon tax. Let's raise it up. Let's not raise it to where North Carolina is or Maryland, but let's raise it almost to those levels.
How many pennies per gallon?
30 cents per gallon, which is what
raise
it is.
Raise it 30 cents a
gallon? No, raise it to 30. Raise it
from
to,
what?
Raise
from 22,
it to,
I think
we're
it
about
is.
15 cents a gallon with the floor on it right
so
now.
So maybe not quite double.
Yeah. But look at Maryland, and this is important for your readers, your listeners here to listen to. I would submit to you, go to gasbuddy.com, which is that website that'll tell you where the gas is. Go to a comparable city in North Carolina where the gas taxes are currently 34 cents a gallon. And remember, Virginia's at about 15.6 cents a gallon. Go compare the prices. The retail price of gasoline is usually cheaper or exactly what it is in Virginia, or maybe a few pennies more, which tells you this. Retailers will charge what the market will bear.
So you get a gas tax, you get more money for Northern Virginia. Where physically do you make changes? So you got the money. What would you do with the money in Northern Virginia particularly? As you know, you were part of Bob McDonald's big transportation plan, which got a lot of favor. Governor McAuliffe is widening roads and changing.
He's widening roads with toll roads.
So you're against toll roads.
Well, with private companies coming in here.
Privatized highway lanes.
Yeah.
I don't
approve of that. That's government ceding its authority over there. And look at the tolls that are going up. You know, look, there are instances where maybe public-private partnerships has a role. But to basically cede over your new transportation improvements to that method. Remember, when you go to tolls, here's what happens. You're taking $2 out of the taxpayer's pocket to build a dollar worth of road. You're getting a dollar to build the road, and you're taking a dollar for financing. So you're going to pay Wall Street a dollar to get a highway built as opposed to paying for it as you go and build your highway infrastructure and let all those that pay the taxes use those highways.
What would you do? And then how would you approach spending money in Northern Virginia? Do you have a transportation plan that I haven't read?
Well, first of all, I put in a bill 2 years in a row that does. There's something called the floor. When we went to a sales tax method of computing taxes collected, you know, I brought up the argument at the statewide level. What if gas prices go down? Gas prices will never go down. Well, then let's put a floor in. I forgot to say in that same breath to the House negotiators, well, let's put the floor in on the regional taxes, too. And had I said that, but that's $100 million plus. And the Washington Post asked me the same question in a debate yesterday. That's $100 million plus. If you earmark that money to capital improvements, that buys a lot of bonds, and that bonds buys a lot of rail cars and other needed
around
improvements.
Around the whole state, not just in Northern Virginia.
This is Northern Virginia regional tax. So this money would be Northern Virginia's own
Northern
money.
Virginia.
It's raised in Northern Virginia would be used if we just put the floor into place. Now, I got that bill out 3 years in a row out of the Senate, only to die in the House. As governor, that bill will pass. I can assure you that.
Our guest is Frank Wagner. He's a member of the Virginia State Senate. He represents the 7th District. He is running for governor of Virginia. If you have questions or comments for him, give us a call at 800-433-8850. Email to Kodjo at WAMU.org. You can send us a tweet at Kodjo Show or go to our website, KodjoShow.org. Ask a question, make a comment, or watch the live video stream there. You, as well as Corey Stewart, have repeatedly described frontrunner Ed Gillespie as a Washington insider. He was, of course, the former chairman of the Republican National Committee. He has, of course, worked as a Washington lobbyist for years. But given Virginia's proximity to Washington and its strong military ties from the Pentagon to the naval base in Norfolk, aren't there some advantages to being a Republican insider at a time when both the White House and the Congress are run by Republicans?
And let me just say this. First of all, you hit it right on the head with military. I'm the only military veteran running for the GOP nomination. And to think I don't have ties or understand what's going on with financing, think again. Our congressman, I'm in close contact with our congressman that sit on key committees, including Congressman Whitman, who's on the House
ran for governor.
Sea Power Subcommittee, absolutely. And so we have those ties. Now, obviously, Gillespie never, you know, wouldn't be caught in the same zip code with Donald Trump. That relationship's not just going to be there, you know, between that and the White House. But let me just say this, that I am the only military veteran in the race, and that's really important to a state with over 800,000 veterans. But being a D.C. insider, he made his millions trading influence in Washington, D.C. And that's fine. I don't regret that. That's certainly a career. But I made the money that I made by starting a business from scratch, wearing a hard hat all my life, working around ship fitters, pipe fitters, welders, some of the finest people in the world, which drives my big single message is career technical education. We have got to reinstill career technical education back in middle school. So what I propose and one of the major education reforms in my administration is going to be we have something in Virginia called Standards of Learning, which is a series
SOLs.
Of tests, SOLs, that you have to pass in order for schools to get accredited and school systems to get accredited. What I proposed is parallel to that, a standards of achievement. Standards of achievement leads towards industry certificates and career technical education. Now, why is that so important? First of all, when we went down the road and No Child Left Behind, we left a lot of children behind. Children who might not be interested in that, children whose skill sets are that. But every business I've talked to in the Commonwealth of Virginia, what's your biggest problem? I can't find technical skilled help. Every
single
company.
That's a nationwide problem.
That's a nationwide problem. So do you blame the job creators? No, you've got to go back and look at the education system, say, what are we doing wrong? And what we've done is this SOL route is wonderful if you want to go to college. But it leaves you void of any career technical skills. So by making young people in the middle school level aware of the opportunities and setting up a program that they can follow down, but more importantly, telling the school superintendent, the school principal, and the guidance counselor, if they pass the standards of achievement test, that counts just as much as they passed an SOL test. So now there's two ways for schools and school systems to get accredited. What's going to happen? The entire school administration is going to start worrying about what's in the best interest of that student, which is where it always should have been. And I just feel so well about that. And let me tell you, it's been 100% received across Virginia. But go ahead, Tom.
Put on your headsets, Tom, because here is Kina in McLean, Virginia. Kina, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question has to do with women's rights, health care rights, and what your opinion is on that. We've had several governors come into Virginia that were very conservative, trying to tell women what they can do and what they cannot do with their bodies. And then my other question is about health care, period, in Virginia. The Republicans would not allow subsidies to come into this area, so thousands of people still were uninsured and still are uninsured. What are your opinions on both of those? Thank you.
I think she's talking about Medicaid expansion that the governor has tried to get through and blocked.
And let me talk about the first issue. Listen, I have a wife, four daughters, and two stepdaughters. So I am definitely concerned about women's health care issues, and remain concerned about that. There are certain things. I mean, if she's asking, am I pro-life? Yeah, I'm pro-life. But, you know, the law of the land has been quite clear by the Supreme Court of the United States. And it is where we function in Virginia. So I think a lot is made about that issues, and I don't see any changes coming up within Virginia that would do that. The law of the land is currently the law of the land. Unfortunately, it becomes a major issue when there's so many other things, like how do I get back and forth to work that impact our daily lives. There are issues of too many college kids coming home that are unemployable, that are sitting on mountains of student debt, that come back and get us and do those kind of things. Now, in terms of healthcare expansion and Medicaid expansion. Let me explain the state budget to you. When I first got there,
how long is that going to take?
25 years, and I'll be as brief as I possibly can. When I got
20 seconds,
there, we had a pie. 8% of that pie was spent on Medicaid. This year, when we passed the budget, 22% of that pie is eaten up by Medicaid, and it continues to grow. It is eating up money for college. It is eating up money for highways. It is eating up money for law enforcement. It is eating money for public safety. It is the Pac-Man of the state budget. Now, to add and double those roles, increase that population by that much, with the state share of that, would mean that we would continue to swallow this depreciating set of pies that we've not been able to appropriate the kind of funds we would to our higher colleges.
The governor said you would have gotten something like $8 billion in federal
funds.
Well,
you know, the governor said a lot of things that I don't necessarily agree with, but the state's portion of that that's required to be paid would have eaten up the significant part of the budget. And that's something, life's a trade-off in doing that. Now we look forward to the future. We have no idea what kind of health care plan is going to come out of Washington, other than I'm certain something will happen in the next year or two. And that's what's going to drive Virginia forward. And that's where experience matters. Who knows what's going on and who's prepared to make those shifts as governor?
Can we go back to Keena's question about women's rights? Because it's an issue in the Democratic Party side, too, and they are all supporting Ralph Northam. You know, there was a transvaginal big issue in this General Assembly. There are repeated attempts to narrow the opportunity for women to have access to abortion rights and requiring health care facilities to have hospital-like standards, all kinds of things like that. You just said it's settled law, but is it settled law? I mean, people who come to Washington every January and demonstrate against Roe v. Wade don't want it to be settled at all. Are you saying it's settled in your mind as far as is would you outlaw abortion if you had the votes?
I think that with the votes in place that, you know, that the certain things, rape, incest, life of the mother, certainly there are sound medical reasons why they did. But again, as I stated earlier, I am pro-life. But certainly those exceptions that stand out have always been in place.
You have said earlier that Ed Gillespie wouldn't get within a stone's throw of President Trump. Many see this off-year statewide election as a kind of referendum on President Trump, and both Democrats in the race are polling ahead of Mr. Gillespie. Do you think this election reflects voters' attitudes towards President Trump, and what would that mean for you?
I think that the money will pour in from all over the country trying to influence this election on both sides of it. That much is typical. Virginia's always been the first state in play. New Jersey and Virginia, the only two states going to be running gubernatorial elections this year. I think it's a foregone conclusion that New Jersey will go Democrat. So this becomes the true battleground. And I think you'll see money and influence and outside influences from both sides pouring into the Commonwealth of Virginia, trying to convince the voters one way or the other.
What is your position on Donald Trump?
I'll give you my position right now. I think he's done a great job on foreign policy. I think his response in Syria was exactly appropriate. This country cannot allow the use of weapons of mass destruction anywhere in the world to be used, and I think it was a measured response. It was done properly. Congress was informed, and I think it sent a signal worldwide. There's a new sheriff in town that's not going to allow that and will respond. I think, secondly, his maneuvers with China. This country cannot allow a nuclear weapon to be put on an intercontinental ballistic missile owned by North Korea. Should have been responded to a decade ago, and I believe his moves with China is a measured response that I hope put the pressure on to convince these folks that don't. But this country cannot allow a rogue nation like that to be able to attack this country, and I think he's responding appropriately.
What about global warming with his withdrawal from the Paris Agreement, which will actually take until 2020 for that to happen? You know Virginia has an international business presence because you're from the ports of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And if the defense budget goes through, that's great, as you've said. There'll be a lot of defense spending in Norfolk and Northern Virginia. But just in the American economy, do you agree with the idea that global warming is not something that the country should be as worried about as some people do, and that it was right to get out of the Paris agreement, which could affect what's done in the economy of Virginia and jobs in Virginia?
I think, first of all, let's take a look at the Paris Agreement and what it really was in impact on global warming or carbon output. I mean, when you start to really analyze it, it is infinitesimal. It was purely voluntary on behalf of every country who entered into it. It allowed countries like China to continue to build. They are building coal plants at a record pace throughout Southeast Asia and the Philippines. Coal usage continues to go up. And then it's the foreign aid programs that were guaranteed and promised to the country of India, just straight cash to them to get them to sign and come on board. It was a bad deal. It was a bad deal for this country, and it was a bad deal for the workers of this country.
Why aren't all these international, multinational business executives, there's a list too long to name, who are out saying the president made a mistake?
I think you're talking about multinational. They'll derive their income from where they can. They're out for the best interest of their stockholders. Their best interest of their stockholders. Never forget, a multinational firm is in the best interest of their stockholders. I think Donald Trump's looking at what's in the best interest of the American worker. And sometimes we get swept up inside of D.C. You forget to see the people that I see around Virginia, the people wearing the hard hats and people doing the hard work that are concerned day to day about their jobs.
We have people who wear hard hats to get through the traffic jams of the growth of the city. There are people working very hard to build private sector businesses. We're not some isolated bubble here in Washington.
No, but I think the attitude doesn't share.
Maybe on Capitol Hill it does, but in my city, there are lots of hard working
people. To disagree with you, Tom, and to try to get a word in, I would say this, they certainly responded in Pennsylvania. They certainly responded in Wisconsin. They certainly responded in Maryland. So I think people here around the D.C. area were stunned at the reaction of those folks that are legitimately concerned about their jobs.
I think if you want to talk about official Washington, that's one thing. But the district, you know, actually has people just like you.
I understand.
Okay.
I understand.
That's
see their votes. And we have them in Northern Virginia, too. But I will say this, that it's a It's a real concern. There are people very, very concerned about their jobs.
What about the argument that people make that this means that the U.S. is withdrawing from its leadership role in the world, abandoning a pact that 200 nations of the world have signed, and that the U.S. was a lead in negotiating?
Well, I think if you listen to Donald Trump's speech yesterday and want to be fair and say everything that he said he's ready to renegotiate on a better terms for the United States. I think he made that quite clear. In fact, he had an open invitation to the members of Congress and the Democrat Party to join him on renegotiating a better deal. So I would hope, as in the course of all the rhetoric about this, that those terms come up. He's not abandoning the deal at all. What he's saying is we need to cut a better deal for America.
Several people would like to join this conversation.
Absolutely.
I thank you for waiting. Here is Majid in Fairfax, Virginia. Majid, your turn.
Hi, Kojo, Tom, and the senator. I live in Fairfax area, and every time I travel to New York, I pay tons of tolls. It seems like in this area we have to pay tons of tolls to get from point A to B. I have a suggestion. Why not make the out-of-state cars pay tolls when they enter Northern Virginia? That brings a lot of money into Northern Virginia for roads.
Out-of-state cars, tolls.
How would that work? That'd be great. We want to do that in the district.
It sounded great. You know, I actually put in, if you dig into my legislative history, I actually put in a bill about 10, 12 years ago, a bi-state compact between us and North Carolina to do precisely that, put a toll on the border between 95, on Interstate 95 between North Carolina and Virginia, and North Carolina unfortunately didn't see it, then came back and said it sounds like a great idea as they started to analyze it. Understand what the rules are. If you do put a toll up on a highway, it's got to be for expansion of that highway and that highway only. So it lane widening or that type of thing would have to be the concern. It's certainly something that we can look at, but once again, a toll is an abdication of the inability to pay for that highway.
We got an email from Syra in Arlington. Today is National Gun Violence Awareness Day. Virginia has seen excessive gun violence, an on-air shooting of a reporter, a massacre at Virginia Tech, and a sniper shooting spree. What does this candidate propose he'll do about gun violence prevention in the Commonwealth?
Well, I think it's a fair question, but I'd have to go to the cities with the most stringent gun control laws that are on the books and tell you that's where the real gun violence is, Southside Chicago. It's one of those areas. The areas where I see the most stringent gun control laws is where the areas that I see the highest rate of gun violence, gang shootings, and that type of thing. So while there's certainly some well-publicized and very unfortunate violent events and the use of firearms, there is in every state. The areas that seem to be the most prevalent in terms of gun violence are those that have the strictest gun control laws. And so, you know, the data
background checks for people who purchase a gun, just so there'll be some registry, not to take the guns away in some massive sweep, but just so we'll know who has them. We had that man arrested this week from the Trump Hotel who had all this AK-15, whatever it was, and other weapons taken right out of the Trump International Hotel. He wanted to see the president.
I understand that, but we do have background checks in Virginia. There's instant background checks, and you go to buy a firearm, you have to check to make sure you're not a felon, and meet the criteria to go out and buy a firearm.
Here's Claudia in Fairfax, Virginia. Claudia, your turn.
Hi, thank you, Kojo. This is just a comment that I'm very scared about all this candidate's perspective and all the policies that he's trying to bring, and he's trying to bring things that Virginians don't like. We didn't vote to Donald Trump for the last year's election, and I think Virginia is not going to vote for him. I'm not voting for him, and I don't think anyone in my radar will vote for someone that tries to implement those policies.
What specific policy of his are you opposed to?
I'm opposed to his pro-life policy, to his gun policy, to his health care policy, and pretty much everything that he said, I'm not in agreement.
Okay, I don't know if he wants to respond to that, because obviously he's hoping that there are others in the Commonwealth to whom he will appeal, and we're running out of time. The opioid crisis is hitting Virginia like many other states. What do you feel needs to be done, and do you agree with the current thinking on the one hand that moves away from criminalizing this addiction, or with Attorney General Jeff Sessions on the other hand, who is asking prosecutors across the country for the harshest penalties that they can?
Okay, let me just say this. All right, let's start with the problem. How did it originate? Okay, and we need to look at the origination. Some is the old traditional things, like when we were growing up, you started using this drug, moved on to this drug, and that addiction. That's a part of it, and we need better education amongst our young people about that. The other avenue to come to addiction is the prescription of basically opioid legitimate pharmaceuticals for pain relief.
The overprescription
of those. Now, we've taken steps in the General Assembly to, A, require that those prescriptions be hand-carried. In other words, you can't call in an opioid prescription, and limit the amount that a doctor can prescribe in a given session as a means to try to stem that. We've talked to our doctors. So the proposal is this. Look, we need to continue down that route, continue education, talk to the medical community about rethinking. Look, there's a certain amount of pain you may just have to deal with, you know, and go through life if it looks to get better, and I understand that. But, once we have an addict, now you have a new problem. Once addicted, until that addict decides they don't want to, you know, they've hit what the – and I have relatives who have been in this position, in-laws that have been in this position and been very well informed, until they hit what they call their bottom and decide that they want to seek some type of treatment, it's not going to happen. Let me just say this, that first of all, when you have an addict that wants that, we need detox facilities. The first step is they got to detox. Okay. The second step is once they've detoxed, we've got to get them into a program. And that it is basically, as I've learned it, lifetime recovery.
Very good.
What's in that program, it's a lifetime. The good news is that program doesn't want any part of the government involvement in it. They're pretty much a self-sufficient program.
Okay, let me ask really quickly, because Ed Gillespie nearly beat Mark Warner, just came a hair's breadth of beating Mark Warner. Shouldn't Republicans just all get together and bolster Ed Gillespie so that he can be the next governor as Republican?
I can answer that.
No, I know he's going to answer no.
I can answer for him.
Well, but he nearly beat Mark Warner. Isn't he a strong candidate for governor?
And I think you got to put it in the context of the times of what it was. First of all, he's running for U.S. Senate, and we all said it's a Washington insider, probably a great job. When people vote for the governor of Virginia, they're hiring somebody to run Virginia. Leave all the rhetoric aside. Leave all those issues aside. They're hiring somebody to run Virginia. That's what this election's all about. Ask yourself, who do you want to run Virginia? And, I hope they come up with Frank Wagner. But you know, at a time when Ed Gillespie didn't win, look at Larry Hogan, who won Maryland, you know, arguably.
So you're the Larry Hogan of Virginia.
Well, we'll see. We'll see.
Frank Wagner is currently a member of the Virginia State Senate representing the 7th District. He is a candidate for governor. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Coach.
Thank you for coming.
And Tom always loved to have the media picking on me all the time.
Well, it was just asking questions and not picking on you.
Oh, well, no. They're fair questions, and I enjoyed the report.
Good luck on June 13th.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed it very much.
Coming up next is Ed Lazier. He is the executive director of the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute. If you have questions about how the council has dealt with Mayor Muriel Bowser's budget in D.C., you can start calling now, 800-433-8850. In the meantime, Tom Sherwood, a fine of $5,100 has been imposed on Ward 4 D.C. council member Brandon Todd for his missteps, if
filed
you will.
Filed up campaign from 2015.
Exactly. During the course of that campaign, he lost track of $100,000 in campaign contributions and had for 15 months not been able to answer auditors' questions about it. He did not produce deposit slips explaining the origin of $83,000 deposited in his 2015 special campaign. He did not give auditors documents they requested to show who made more than $68,000 in deposits through his PayPal. And the fine of $5,100 is getting a lot of pushback, even from
some. Well, it's a pretty good business deal. Maybe, you have $100,000 sloshing around, you pay $5,000 for it, you're $95,000 to the good. And he still hasn't explained all of the 2015, and there's still some questions about 2016. Although this is the best, the Office of Campaign Finance combined all of his violations into one to make it so they could fine him $5,000. Could have been, maybe some people say, should have been much larger to send a message. Now the issue is, will the D.C. Council see this slap on the finger not a slap on the wrist even, as a reason to change the laws for tougher financial penalties if you don't run your own campaign right.
Ed Lazier is here. He is the executive director of the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute. What do you think? This fine was appropriate or not?
That's not the kind of thing I tend to comment on, so I'm going to leave that to you two guys.
Brandon Todd is one of 13 votes he needs.
I'm always looking for friends on the city council.
Okay. Then
you agree that the laws ought to be clear, though, about what campaign finance laws are?
Absolutely. I agree with that. Yep.
Earlier this week, the D.C. Council gave preliminary approval to the largest budget in its history. In broad terms, what does that final budget look like?
Well, that looks like a lot of things, although I think, budgets are complex things. So there are lots of good things in this budget that I care about, including protecting vulnerable children and investing in schools. But I think the budget is actually more notable for what's not there, that we didn't use this budget to use the city's growing resources to do more to help residents who are not succeeding in this prospering economy and to do more to help this city's future. So, for example, there's no money in this budget to take anybody off our housing authority wait list. We didn't put enough money into schools to match what experts said was recommended, knowing that that meant that, in particular, high-poverty schools wouldn't get the money that they had
been
promised.
Were they experts or advocates?
Yeah, it was a mixture.
Okay.
Yeah.
They wanted 3.5%, and you got 3.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. And we have a homeless service plan that had originally committed to ending homelessness in 2017, and it keeps getting pushed back. So with this budget, we still are leaving lots of people living on the street. And at the same time, the budget includes substantial amount of tax cuts, including tax cuts for wealthy estates and for profitable corporations. So it just didn't seem like the right choice for D.C., to me, to be moving forward with tax cuts for wealthy estates and for profitable businesses at a time when we can't adequately fund housing, schools, and homeless services and other things.
But you were a member of the Tax Revision Commission under the former Mayor Anthony Williams.
I was an honored member of that commission, yes.
And that was the commission that recommended the tax cuts that have now become reality. Remind us of why those tax cuts were in there to begin with, since you were a member of that commission. What was the original intention of the tax cuts?
Well, I guess I would like to say one thing first, which is that the package that the council actually adopted wasn't exactly what the commission recommended. So I was honored to serve on the commission and proud of what we did. One of the things that the council did not do, the commission recommended a lot of tax cuts. We also recommended some tax increase to offset the costs. And the D.C. Council and mayor have not done all the tax increases. So it was a much more expensive package than it needed to be. And the other is that the council decided to push these tax cuts through in a pretty aggressive pace and really said at a certain point, if the city finds that it's taking in more money because our economy is growing, every dollar of that increased revenue goes to tax cuts and none of it would be available for services. And I just thought that was imbalanced. So I think it's important to note that what has been happening in the council isn't even exactly what the commission recommended. But in terms of what we looked at, we sort of had two broad things we looked at. The commission had a lot of research that showed that taxes on hardworking, low and moderate income families were high, and we made a lot of recommendations to adjust those. Mm-hmm. We also took a close look at the business taxes and commission studies because we wanted to see if our business taxes were creating a problem. And sort of to my surprise, we found that it wasn't. So one study, for example, showed that our business taxes or our income taxes are actually in line with Maryland and Virginia, not significantly different. And the other study said our economy is outperforming the rest of the region, which it still is, and therefore said it's not really clear we need to revisit our business taxes. But the commission included business representatives and business interests, and they kept pushing because they felt like there should be something for them, even though the research that was presented us didn't really justify it.
I think the point, you were a member of that commission and you voted for it, so that's good. It was a series of changes that would be made in the tax structure, including the early one of reducing the income tax for middle-income people who make $40,000 to $60,000. Instead of being charged 8.5%, they were charged 6.5%. That was very good for middle-class people. So there were a lot of give and take things. And Mayor Tony Williams, who chaired the commission, said to me when I talked to him about your position, he said, look, this was a package of things where people liked some things, they didn't like others, and this went in over a three-year period. And so is it fair to just take out now what he didn't say, it, but I'll say it, cherry-pick the things you don't like and leave them out, when in fact this was a package passed by the council in 2014. The city has plenty of money. to do everything you've just suggested, whether they have the will or not.
It doesn't have plenty of money. I mean, the bottom line is we ended up with a budget that didn't fully fund schools.
No, I'm not saying with the budget, but we have the monies available if you appropriate it right. That's what there's plenty. It's not like the city is looking for money to raise money. The money's there. The city's like the budget's like $4 billion more than it was just a few years ago.
I don't agree. I think if the council and mayor had enough money to end homelessness and fully fund schools, they would. I don't think they would consciously choose not to do that. So I don't actually think there's enough money. And when you cut taxes, you don't have the resources to invest.
Nevertheless, you have said this budget falls short of the goal of inclusive prosperity.
Absolutely.
Where specifically does it fall short?
Well, we are cutting taxes for people who have estates that are worth $5.5 million, and I know that next year I'm still going to walk from the metro to my office and pass a row of people who are sleeping in tents because we haven't put up enough money to take those people off the street and give them the homes that they deserve. Even though we have a plan and we made a commitment to ending homelessness, we haven't met that plan. So it's a little puzzling to me that we've decided that, given where we are in the city with rampant gentrification that's squeezing a lot of families and pushing a lot of Black and Hispanic families out, that the main commitment we need to keep is to a tax cut package rather than to a commitment to fully fund schools or a commitment to end homelessness. Why are tax cuts our top commitment? I actually don't think that that's the way most D.C. residents think.
Well, there is no evidence that wealthy people in any significant number are moving out of the city because the tax burden
that's
is too
right.
high. That's true.
Absolutely.
A lot of people like to say, well, I'm going to move to Maryland. And some very wealthy people. But the estate tax, I think it's one of the principal things that was at issue this week with the council, would raise what every year, about $15 million more or something like that?
Well, the tax
would be a loss. It would be a loss of about $15 million if it went to $5 million.
That's right. So
which is the federal state.
Right. And it's important to note that as a result of the commission, the estate tax threshold has already been increased from
$1 million
to $2 million. So
that's
you don't owe a tax if your estate is worth $2 million. And now we're going to which perhaps is helpful to people who have a lot of assets because their home has grown in value, which is not surprising in D.C. But $5.5 million, that's pretty clearly wealthy.
But under the law, even if you have a $5 million estate and you transfer it to your family or charities, you don't pay that tax anyway. So there are only a few people pay the tax.
Well, right. I don't know the precise numbers, but it's roughly 25 to 50 estates that are covered by the tax every year. That's what we did. We gave thousands and thousands of tax cuts to a small number of very wealthy estates while denying 90,000 children in schools the funding that people say is needed to fully fund
education. One of your critics said today, the Fiscal Policy Institute does good work because it does study the budget of what's not being done. But it should study, and maybe you have done this, like the Department of Employment Services. It gets plenty of money, some people say, plenty of money. But there's no study that shows that it does anything worthwhile, that it gets people employed and keeps them employed for 6 months. Has your group, the Fiscal Policy Institute, studied that? Because maybe the money can be spent better, not just more money, I think is the bottom line.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I want the city's resources to be used wisely and effectively to meet the needs of D.C. residents. And so that means good program. So we actually, as an organization, don't advocate for a lot of increase in job training because at this point we think that what's needed is better coordination among programs and better accountability.
Right.
So if you read through our testimony, we're not asking for more money for job training. We're asking for improvements in the Department of Employment Services, exactly what you're talking about.
All right, good.
The council did approve funding for a number of programs for affordable housing and homelessness, including basic assistance to families. What's your critique of those?
No critique there. I mean, again, the question is whether we're doing enough. So I do think it's worth pointing out that one of the things that the mayor and council agreed to do was protect 10,000 children in vulnerable families from potentially losing all income assistance when we know the research across the country shows that those families just tend to fall into deep poverty, and that creates lots of problems, including parents children who aren't able to do well in school, parents who aren't able to keep their jobs, those sorts of things. So that was a really positive move. The question is really, are we doing enough as a city, giving our rising prosperity and the resources we have, and yet the problems from that rising prosperity, particularly the loss of affordable housing, are we doing enough? And the reality is that we're spending more on affordable housing, and it's doing good things. It's still just 3% of the budget. For a city where affordable housing is such – a tremendous challenge. We've got to do something that's really on a much larger scale than what we're doing now. And that's why I was concerned and continue to be concerned that we were prioritizing tax cuts that aren't clear that they're going to do anything to help our economy while not investing in D.C. residents who are struggling.
We got an email from Marcia in Ward 4. Please ask why the council decided not to delay cuts to the inheritance tax, which only affects the richest citizens, nor to delay the business franchise cuts, leaving the cuts in place for small businesses. The council could have gotten the 3.5% increase in the education budget without chopping the budget for public safety officers. Sounds to me like council members are terrified of offending the 1% who, after all, provide lots of funding for election campaigns. Let's talk a little bit about that, because the mayor was not 100% on board with the final budget. Her spokesperson noted that the public is concerned about crime. There was a spate of shootings this week in the district. This budget includes police and fire department cuts. Was that less of a concern for you and obviously for the council?
I can't speak for the council. And as an organization, the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute, we're a small organization and we're limited in our size based on fundraising that we're able to do. So we don't have we are starting to do work on criminal justice reform, but we have not historically. I mean, I think one of the questions is what's the best way to reduce crime? I mean, I guess, first of all, I think I don't know the statistics probably as well as you do, but crime is on a long-term downward slide of the city, even if it has
nationwide
bumps.
Too.
Yeah,
right.
So it's not
except
it's,
for Chicago, I think.
Yeah, right. So it's not necessarily clear that it's a huge growing problem. It's always something we want to be dealing with. But then there's also the question of what's the best way to reduce crime if we have people who are living in communities with high poverty and under stress, and that's contributing to crime. Is the solution to crime more police, or is the solution to crime more treating it as a social and economic problem?
I want to get back to the issue Tom raised earlier about how big this budget is in comparison to previous budgets. The district is spending its largest budget in history, and some wonder whether there's enough accountability and oversight, including D.C. Auditor Kathy Patterson. What are your thoughts about that?
I agree that we could be doing more as a city, all of us, sort of inside government and outside government, to be reviewing what we're doing. I don't know about the size of the government growing necessarily. I mean, just because of inflation and other rising costs, it's going to be that the budget's going to grow every year. The federal budget probably grows every year as well. Most state budgets are growing every year, so it's probably the case.
A hollow argument.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think if you looked at documents, you'd see that every state budget is probably the highest it's ever been. I mean, they don't tend to cut. They tend to grow, and the questions are they growing enough to meet the rising needs? But certainly, I believe the council could be doing more. I believe the agencies themselves could be doing more, and we in the nonprofit community could be doing more to hold D.C. government accountable for better services.
This is probably the most progressive council that I've seen since the first council of the 1970s, which was very aggressive when it took office, did a lot of things, the Handgun Control Act and other. And most of the council members, I think many of them say they are, in fact, progressive. But the vote on this budget was, what was it, 9-4 or 10-3?
Well, no. I think the vote you're talking about is around the estate tax. So it right. is. Yes, I was going to mention.
The ultimate vote was unanimous.
Yeah. But other than the estate tax, which I think is not that big of in terms of $14 billion budget, we're talking about millions of dollars. What other things did you object to in the budget? You mentioned a couple. I just want to bring them back.
What were the things?
Anything other than the estate tax and that? It's like $100 million in tax changes next January, the 2018. The estate tax is only a small part of it.
The estate tax is about $12 million cut in business income taxes from small businesses all the way up to Walmart is $28
million. Right.
And then there's a range of other cuts that are targeted on low and moderate income families that are $60 million.
So Tony Williams said, again, when I talked to him about this, I keep bringing him up because he's the former mayor and because he led the tax commission. He said that if you look at the things that have been done by this council, which he said he supported all of them, the minimum wage change, the paid family leave, sick leave, welfare TANF extensions, raising the sales tax, any number of changes he said have done to help fund the government and the things that you advocate as part of the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute. He says only a couple of times in the last 10 years or so, 12 years, has there been any relief for the commercial businesses that, in fact, fund the government.
Well, we have cut taxes for businesses as a result of the commission, and we have not raised taxes on any business as long as I have been doing this work. So
2001, right?
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Okay. And the as a result of the commission, the tax rate on businesses already did go down, and what was going to happen next year is a further reduction. I think of my father owned a small business. That small businesses are what create jobs, which is what every person needs to succeed. So I'm not against the business community, but I think there's a question of if we have a strong economy, if our economy is actually outperforming the region, businesses are doing well, it's not clear why a tax cut is needed for them. We can be doing other things
because
to make sure.
Because it was part of a deal people voted on in 2014 and said, we will do these as the money is available. The money's available. If you can, I'll quote someone else who said, if you can cherry pick the estate tax out of this package, why can't the business community cherry-pick something else?
Well, they absolutely could. I mean, I think I've gone through the reasons.
We've got about a minute left.
I also think it's important. I just, for my own credibility, I was on the commission, and for 3 years I didn't oppose I didn't say we should stop any of the tax cuts. And it was only this year when we got to the point where where I was faced with, we're cutting taxes for people with $5 million estates while we can't fund schools and homeless services. We should be doing something about this. What I really have been arguing mostly is to slow down the pace of the tax cuts so that we can do a balance between investing in our communities and tax cuts. And that also got rejected. So
Can you change this over in the next week, 10 days before the council may takes a final vote?
The first vote in the council tends to be the final vote. Right. So I don't expect it to change in the second.
But there's always next year.
There's always next year. Okay.
Well, the council is looking at the Trump budget, and it may include possible cuts in the federal workforce and seem to be anticipating that there could be a faltering economy in the city. Do you foresee that at all?
I mean, I continue to pray for the chaos and confusion within the White House that we're seeing right now, and hope that that results in not having substantial cuts. I mean, what I've heard, and I'm not a federal budget expert, is that to get the budget passed, it's very likely Congress is going to need the Democrats' support. So I am hopeful that we'll get through this federal budget without the dramatic
even the Republicans. Even the Republicans say that the president's skinny budget has no sense of reality to it.
Ed Lazier is the executive director of the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Don't forget to meet us back here Monday at noon. We'll be talking about recent incidents in our region of nooses being left on campuses and even inside the Museum of African American History and Culture. We'll discuss modern-day manifestations of racism. That's all at noon on Monday. Tom Sherwood, somebody has been running around Southwest.
Cell phone?
No, pasting things that are supposed
horrible.
To be from
those
ICE.
Things, it's all part of a whole pattern of things across the country that are just disgusting. We can stand up to them.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
The Kojo Nnamdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Ruth Tam, Avery Kleiman, and Taria Rogers. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Cliff Gallagher has been on the phones. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nnamdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.